You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we hear from a woman who was trafficked for sex as a teenager, and she'll talk about why it's dangerous to assume it can't happen in your own community. First, it's time for our weekly review of state news. It's been a huge week for political news with Donald Trump winning the White House. So we're going to cover some news from the past week that you might have missed in all the election and post-election analysis. One of these stories broke yesterday. Wisconsin Appeals Court voided an almost $300,000 judgment for demonstrators who were cited for holding signs during protests in 2011 against Governor Scott Walker's collective bargaining restrictions. Robert Menser joins us now, as he does every Friday at this time, to break down this and other top stories from the past week. He's a storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin, based in Wausau. Rob, welcome back.
Hello. Thanks for having me back.
Well, over 5 years ago, Act 10 was in the news. Here's a little bit of what it sounded like.
When I say union, you say power. Union!
Power!
Union!
Power!
Union!
Power!
Union!
That's the sound of protesters in 2011 when Scott Walker introduced his bill restricting collective bargaining. That law is known as Act 10. And Rob, what's the latest ruling that voids a judgment for demonstrators?
Yes, so this was... Listeners, I guess, will have heard this and described in the top of the hour news there. But yeah, basically the judgment that awarded those protesters about $300,000 in damages and lawyer fees has been thrown out. This is a case where we all remember these protests, and it certainly seems like the First Amendment would protect political protesters doing political speech in a public place like the Capitol. And in fact, that is what was found, that it was First Amendment speech, so that was protected. It's also notable here that the actual state policy was changed in 2013. So the state had this policy that you could only have signs in a place if you had a permit to have signs. And so these folks who came to protest the Act 10 law brought with them signs, and then they got tickets for having signs where they weren't supposed to have signs. So that policy is gone. That administrative policy is gone. They were never arrested. This was like they were cited. This was ticketed. So they appealed, and they wanted to argue that this policy, whether or not it's in effect now, was unconstitutional. So a court found it was, and now in the latest ruling, court found that maybe it was, maybe it wasn't. But what they couldn't prove was that it was beyond debate that it was a violation of their constitutional rights, which is what's required to get those funds and damages.
So that was an appeals court. So is there a next step? Does it keep going and get appealed again, higher up?
So it could, right? But the Wisconsin State Journal, which reported on this, had the group's lawyer saying that it was unlikely that they would appeal it further. So this is probably the end of the line for this civil lawsuit. The thing to understand, all right, so we have the First Amendment, we have a right to free speech, political speech, but there are constitutional restrictions allowed by time, place, and manner. And so the finding was that somebody who wrote these protesters this ticket could have had a good faith understanding that what they were doing was not, they were not sort of setting about to violate anyone's civil rights, but they were enforcing a constitutional time, place, and manner restriction. But really, I mean, you could say I would still call it a sort of a moral victory for the protesters, because the fact is you can carry a sign in, you can do a protest in the Capitol if you want to.
We're talking with Rob Menser right now, storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin, based in Wausau. And Rob, we're moving to some Great Lakes news now. The first invasive species in the Great Lakes since 2008 was just discovered. What is it?
Yes. So, well, what is it? It's the Thermocyclops crassus, which is, I think, a great name. I love that name. So it's a little tiny zooplankton that is brought over by these large ships, this particular organism was discovered. The EPA just released this week that it was discovered in the Great Lakes. It is the 186th invasive species in the Great Lakes, and we don't really know what the actual impact of this is. The risk with invasive species is always that they can, you know, if there is no sort of natural predator or, you know, check to their to them spreading in the new ecosystem, that they can take over and mess up the ecosystem. There's not evidence that that has happened here, but the fact that after some amount of success in keeping invasive species out, that this was discovered is certainly seen as a worrying sign by environmentalists, and some folks are saying it's an argument for stricter regulations on the ships that are coming in.
Right, and it sounds like what we're talking about here is something called ballast water, and it sounds like, maybe you can clear this up, but it sounds like these big ships come in and they have water from different parts of the world in these holding tanks to help right the ships, and then they enter Great Lakes water, and sometimes there's little critters in there that get off in the Great Lakes.
That's it. That's it. Exactly. Yeah, they hold the water as ballast to keep the ship steady. And there is a current regulation that they are supposed to dump that water in the middle of the ocean if they're coming from Asia or wherever, and take in mid-ocean water, which is less risky, or, you know, less likely to have these invasive species. There's also an EPA standard. They are beginning the sort of phasing in, according to this report, which the Journal Sentinel wrote about this. They're phasing in what are called ballast disinfection systems that are supposed to keep that water clean, but that has been a little bit controversial because there's, you know, on the environmental side, they say that the phase in goes too slow, that it's not, that there aren't protections enough.
So that's when we'll keep watching and maybe find out what the effects of this particular zooplankton might be down the road as well.
Thermocyclops crassus. Look for it.
You really like the name. All right. Well, we're going to move on to our final story with you, Rob. Election Tuesday, and there were a lot of local Wisconsin races on the ballot, but not necessarily a lot of candidates there. What happened?
Well, so this is an interesting story. Wisconsin Public Radio reported this, and the Associated Press picked it up. That what they're finding is not so much for these fall ballots, but for Wisconsin's spring elections for local offices. Nobody wants to run for local office. The League of Wisconsin Municipalities and the Wisconsin Taxpayer Association did a survey. They found that 52% of cities and villages overall say that it's a problem. Two-thirds of cities and villages with under 10,000 population have essentially no competition for their, you know, a town board or a city council or a county board. So you have unopposed races or just a blank ballot. And so, you know, it's not a total shock, because in a lot of cases rural places that have declining populations, it makes a little bit of sense that it would be hard to be getting harder to fill these offices. But it is a problem. It is a looming problem, because, in fact, they make a lot of decisions, and their decisions affect people's lives in these places.
Now, in several speeches this week post-election, Democrats in particular struck a tone encouraging civic engagement, wanting people to get out there and be more active in their communities, maybe running for office. Do you think that we may see more civic engagement after this last election?
You know, it is interesting. Clearly, there are a lot of Democrats who are feeling very, very dejected this week. And I will say, in 2009, when we saw the Tea Party movement start to take hold here in central Wisconsin, I recall seeing a lot of people running for local, you know, a school board, a county board, a town board office, who very much identified themselves as kind of Tea Party people who wanted to be part of that political movement. So it is a thing that happens. People, you know, often it's at the local level, the sort of grassroots level, that people get involved. It's, you know, who knows, right? It's a little early to tell, but to the extent that there's the Democratic Party or liberals in general have rebuilding to do from the bottom up, is often the way that happens.
Well, Rob, thanks a lot. We'll talk to you next week.
All right. Thank you.
That was Robert Menzer, storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin, based in Wausau. And he joins us every Friday to talk about the week's top Wisconsin news stories. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, before the election, the Republican Party was fractured between supporters of Donald Trump and those who were staunchly against him. Our guest says healing the rift is priority number one. First, human trafficking might seem like something that happens in far-off places and happens to other people, but our next guest shares her own story as a survivor of sex trafficking to raise awareness that it could happen in any community and to any person. Teresa Flores is a human trafficking survivor, author, and victims advocate, and she's the keynote speaker at an event tomorrow in Green Bay. Teresa, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Well, you were trafficked for sex when you were only 15 years old. First of all, would you describe your life before the trafficking and what it was like for you growing up?
Yeah, I consider myself having just been a normal, average, all-American girl. Two parents, my mom didn't work, three younger brothers, Irish Catholic, and I would say upper middle class. And just was a good family. I wasn't molested or abused, anything like that. I had a normal upbringing. And what made my life a little different than maybe most of the listeners is that I moved around every 2 years. My dad was a big executive, so he would get promoted and transferred. And so I didn't have really a lot of support around me. I didn't have any family that lived near us. And so I would just get kind of used to an area and then get uprooted again. So that's what kind of made my life a little different than most people's.
So how did the trafficking start?
You know, I just simply moved to a new place that I hadn't, you know, lived before, a little different than in the past, very upper class. And I just met a boy. I mean, it was just very innocent. It was in my high school, and my parents were pretty strict and didn't allow me to date until I was 16. And this boy was a lot different than any of the other boys that I kind of grew up with. He was very suave, very sweet talker, very, very cute. And for 6 months, really, he was always around and giving me compliments. We can call that courting. But if it's a malintent, it's actually grooming. And so he would offer to walk me to class and everything. And so it seemed very innocent to me. And I am, you know, very naive. And one day he just asked me if I wanted a ride home from school. It was as simple as that.
And what happened at that point?
So I jumped at the chance. I thought, you know, this is not a date. We're fine. And so I went with him thinking that he was going to take me home. But unfortunately, he didn't. He said he had forgotten something at his house and said, I just need to run there and grab it. And I had an odd feeling. Something felt wrong, but I didn't, you know, want to be weird. And I wanted him to like me. And so I thought, okay, we'll just swing by his house. But we went to his house and he asked me to come inside. He gave me a pop, and it was laced with drugs. Mm. And then I was raped. And when I went home that afternoon after that, I made a really bad decision. I decided not to tell my parents. And I thought at the moment it was a good decision because I didn't want them to see me differently, to be angry that I went with him. I felt just very ashamed of it. And I had been a virgin. And unfortunately, a few days later, it got worse because he came up to me at school with an envelope, and in that envelope were pictures.
And so he blackmailed you.
Yeah. His two older brothers had been there taking the photos and then said, you know, we'll show these to your father, his boss, all around school, the church, you know, that I was involved in, and said, you have to do what we say when we say, or we're going to show these to everyone.
It sounds like a situation, the way it started, that you can see happening very easily to, you know, any girl who had an interest, you know, with a cute boy who was giving her attention. And yet it took this really dark and horrible turn. So at that point, why did you decide not to tell your parents what was happening and expose the blackmail and these three brothers?
Well, first of all, you got to remember, you know, I was 15, and so part of it was because of the blackmail that I didn't want them to know. But a bigger part of it was that they threatened to kill my family. They said, "We're going to hurt your brothers." And there are a lot of people in town who are afraid of these guys. So it was kind of what you might call like your upper class gang. The teachers at school, everybody was very afraid of them. And they would follow me home from school when I was walking with my brother, or they would come to where I worked at and just stood in the door. So they were very, very threatening as well, physically and emotionally.
I'm so sorry for what you went through hearing this. I mean, I know it's been a long time, but I can't imagine that the pain ever totally goes away. What made you decide to come out with this and tell people what you'd been through?
So about 10 years ago, actually it's 10 years this month, I went to a conference in Columbus, Ohio, where I'm from, and I learned about the definition of human trafficking. And I sat there in that chair, and I was just stunned because I thought, oh my gosh, this is what happened to me. I never knew it was called this. And, you know, here I have a master's degree. So I'm a licensed social worker. And I thought, if I don't know this and I lived through it, how many others don't know this too? And my daughter was actually turning the age of what I had been when I had been first trafficked. And I thought, I've got to open my mouth. And we didn't have strong laws against it in Ohio. And I walked right up to a senator and said, you know, maybe the people that are voting on laws will listen to me because I look like an average American kid, you know, person now, and maybe they'll listen to my story. And from that moment, I never turned back.
We're talking with Teresa Flores right now. She's a human trafficking survivor, also an author and a victim's advocate, and she's a keynote speaker at an event tomorrow in Green Bay. There's a link, by the way, up about that on the Central Time Facebook page. And Teresa, listening to you talk, I can imagine that one assumption people may make about human trafficking, one, is that it doesn't happen in my community. That's, you know, something that happens in some sort of seedy part of the country that I've never been to. I don't know, some place we don't think about. Another is that maybe it just happens to girls. What are some of the assumptions that we make like that?
Well, 80% are women and girls, but there are 20% that are men and boys. The FBI has told us that we know for sure there's 100,000 kids being trafficked in the U.S. right now. So that means 20,000 boys as well. So this is not a small problem that we have. You know, there are a lot of generational prostitution and for drugs in the inner city and with minorities for labor trafficking. But this is something that we're seeing all across the country, even a lot in the rural areas as well.
Now, you're the keynote speaker at this event tomorrow morning in Green Bay, and some of the points that organizers have emphasized are that trafficking can happen in smaller urban communities like those in Northeast Wisconsin, and that large-scale events, sometimes football games, Packers games, the EAA can create demand for sex traffickers. And I think that might be something that comes as a shock to some people. What do you think the connection is there? What do people need to know about that?
Yeah, I have a program called SOAP, which stands for Save Our Adolescents from Prostitution. And we go out during big sporting events and any event where they bring a lot of people to a town. And we look for missing children. A lot of time these missing and runaway kids are being trafficked. And we talk to hotels and motels about this to see if they know what the signs are if somebody walks in that's being trafficked. We just know that during big events like this, the demand for sex for sale rises. I mean, it quadruples. There's an internet site called Backpage.com. It's similar to Craigslist, but you can actually buy a person on Backpage. And we track that during events like the Packer games, and we go to the Super Bowl every year. And we know that those ads for girls for sale, which many of them are not doing this by choice, they're being posted on there by a pimp or a trafficker, and they quadruple during any big event.
Teresa, what do you want people to know about what to look for, the signs of human trafficking, so that they can intervene and hopefully help?
There's just so many. Young girls that are inappropriately dressed, maybe out late at night on a school night, hanging around older guys. We had a group go out to a hotel on a Saturday afternoon and noticed a young African-American girl, about 15 or 16, kind of all made up, walking into the motel with this older, 50, 60-year-old white guy. And we know that that's what that was. We've seen one guy dropping off four girls to a hotel and leaving them there to work. So those are just some of the signs. There's so many of them. It just depends on what kind of situation you're in.
What kind of public policy or public awareness campaign would you like to see to help turn this around?
Oh, there's many. There's one that is releasing all of the expungements, all the problems that the women have had. And I think that Wisconsin does have that law where many of them are arrested for prostitution and have felonies and later in life can't get jobs or housing. And they'll actually expunge that, which is fantastic. There's a safe harbor law that we have in Ohio that says you cannot arrest a child, someone under 18, for prostitution. And unfortunately, we see that happen all across the country and don't realize that that's really that they're being trafficked. They're not a criminal. In Michigan, they passed a law with my name on it, removing the statute of limitations for any child who's ever been trafficked. So that means, if they're 17 years old, they have until the rest of their life to actually go after that person. Because many times these laws are 6 years or 20 years. And believe me, 20 years, even after I turned 17, I still wasn't ready to prosecute them.
Teresa, thank you so much for joining us and for sharing your story.
You're welcome. I just also want to mention my book that they can get if they're not able to come tomorrow. I have a TED Talk also, but I have two books out. One is The Slave Across the Street, which is my personal story, and then Slavery in the Land of the Free, and that's a student's guide to learning more about modern-day slavery.
Thank you so much. That was Teresa Flora. She's a human trafficking survivor, author, and victims advocate. She's a keynote speaker at an event tomorrow in Green Bay. A link for that event, which is free, is up on the Central Time Facebook page. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up tonight at 7, it's Ken Rudin's Political Junkie. Tonight, Donald Trump swept nearly all the swing states on Tuesday to win the presidential election, a victory that the polls and the pundits failed to anticipate. Rudin looks at the election results and considers the challenges that the future Trump administration could face. That's coming up tonight at 7 on the Ideas Network. First, for the last year and a half, the American people have watched a presidential campaign unfold that heightened the partisan differences in the country. But what came as a surprise was the split among GOP members, people who at least at first glance shared the same political viewpoint. The split seemed to divide supporters of Donald Trump and members of the so-called GOP establishment. But our next guest thinks the time is right for an internal truce, for Republicans to come together and unite behind the next wave of conservative policies. And we'd like to hear from you on this. Are you a Republican? Maybe a Republican who was torn between competing ideologies during this election. And what is your hope for the party? What would you like to see done? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page. And joining us now to talk about this is Mario Loyola. He is a senior fellow at the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty and a contributing editor at the National Review. Mario, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you wrote an article just before the election where you outlined your argument for a truce in the GOP's what you call a civil war. Set the stage. What was the state of the GOP just before the election?
Well, at the beginning of the election cycle, we had the Tea Party wave that started in the years right after the Obama election, the elections of 2010 and 2012, which gave the Republican Party big victories, control of the House of Representatives, control of the Senate. And that was a very focused sort of ideological movement focused on constitutional reforms, constitutional protection, kind of very basic anti-establishment in the sense of, you know, not being happy with the way that things were run, not being happy with, you know, government by special interests, government by lobbyists. They were very anti-earmarks, this kind of thing. But they got into this tendency. I mean, they saw themselves as reviving the spirit of the American Revolution, of James Madison, Alexander Hamilton, Ben Franklin, the Constitution. But sometimes they kind of veered off into the spirit of the French Revolution. And the French Revolution, of course, was a much more fratricidal revolution, and, you know, the Jacobins sending each other to the guillotine for infractions of ideological purity. And it was a much more kind of a doctrinaire affair in France. And that was... that was unfortunate because it kind of set this tenor of recrimination and, you know, violating Reagan's 11th commandment, thou shalt not speak ill of a fellow Republican. And so it's in the midst of this sort of recriminations between sitting senators and the Senate Majority Leader and between House members and other House members within the Republican Party that Donald Trump arrives. And then, of course, we had a much bigger recriminations during the campaign season between the Never Trump faction and the pro-Trump faction. And, you know, and so I just kind of want to say, can't we just get along? I mean, because no one's going to get what they want except for through a unified party machinery that works well, and frankly, through a unified legislature that works well for both parties through the give and take of legislation, something that Bill Clinton could speak to, something that people in the 90s are well aware of from the welfare reform efforts and a lot of accomplishments that crossed party lines during the 90s.
Well, it's been 3 days about since Donald Trump was declared the winner of this presidential election. What do you see happening? Do you see some of this, those divisions maybe not evaporating, but maybe being put behind in the excitement about what comes next?
I think that there is a sort of recognition on the part of the various tendencies within the Republican Party to think about the possibilities now and think sort of optimistically. You know, optimism hasn't been fashionable for a while. Being a respectable politician hasn't been very respectable for a while. And maybe it's time for being a respectable politician to become respectable again. I mean, I think that you've got, you know, Paul Ryan, the Speaker of the House, did what I think is, frankly, a really brilliant job of this bottom-up approach that he's been pursuing doggedly for a year. You know, his program, A Better Way, The Better Way for the Republican Party, which is an agenda of tax reforms and refixing poverty programs and the Constitution and the economy and healthcare reform. And there's a lot of that. That was a very important process because it's not just a couple of bright Republicans talking to themselves and trying to figure out, you know, what would we like the Constitution to look, you know, what would we like the country to look like? This was an actual, you know, he gave different pieces of this out to committee chairmen, and they went out to their constituents, and they had town halls, and it was really like a grassroots up kind of a thing to figure out what would work. What are people actually going to vote for? Because you can have your strong opinion, and I have my strong opinion, but what we've lost sight of in this country, I think, too much, is that we need to convince a majority of the people to agree with us. And in some cases, we need to convince a large majority of the people to agree with us, including lots of people of the other party. And it's only through this kind of grassroots development of policy that you have a chance of getting there. So now it's a year. It's a year after Speaker Ryan announced this initiative, and we've got a set of proposals, and they're fleshed out. And so now the question is there overlap between this and the president and president-elect Trump's agenda? And there appears to be a great deal of overlap. So, you know, the Trump administration starts, I think, with Republicans, at least at this couple of days after the election, on a positive note, and mindful of the fact that it's very difficult to have a successful administration, even in the best of times, and even if you're the most well-prepared of presidents.
We're talking with Mario Loyola right now. He is a contributing editor at the National Review and also a senior fellow at the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, talking about what's next for the Republican Party and what the party can do to heal the rifts within its own rank. And you were talking about Paul Ryan's approach. And yesterday, Donald Trump visited Capitol Hill. He talked with House Speaker Paul Ryan. And as you were saying, these two did not always see eye to eye. In fact, sometimes things were pretty acrimonious between the two of them. But Ryan yesterday sounded as though he was ready to work. And here's their exchange.
Donald Trump had one of the most impressive victories we've ever seen. And we're going to turn that victory into progress for the American people. And we are now talking about how we're going to get the ground running to make sure that we can get this country turned around and make America great again.
Well, thank you very much. And Mr. Speaker, it's been an honor. We had a meeting. I met with the president, as you know, before. That was an excellent meeting. We just spent quite a bit of time together. I think we're going to do some absolutely spectacular things for the American people. We look forward to starting. In fact, truthfully, we can't get started fast enough.
Donald Trump speaking with House Speaker Paul Ryan. That was recorded yesterday. And do you see some of these rifts healing? Do you see Donald Trump and Paul Ryan being able to work together? Or do you see some of these rifts that began, these fractures during the campaign, deepening within this next couple of years?
Well, I think that history provides a good clue to how to answer that question. I mean, lots of presidential administrations start on a very hopeful note. Even, the opposing party tends to give the incoming president the benefit of the doubt and sort of extend an open hand. And then, the reality of politics starts to take over. And, like I said a moment ago, it's very difficult to have a successful administration, even in the best of times. And, politics is hard, and it's hard to leave with the same approval rating that you had coming in. But I think there's a recognition that a lot is possible if the different strands of the Republican Party are willing to put aside their differences and work together. And frankly, I mean, it's not just the need for unity within the Republican Party. The Republicans have 52 votes in the Senate, and that means that under the rules of the Senate, you normally need 60 votes to get legislation moved because of the rules attached to what we call cloture. And so, the Republicans are going to need 8 Democratic senators on a regular basis to get to move stuff. And I think that, that's good because this is a time when people have to kind of relearn the fine art of compromise.
Now, in this piece, the reason we reached out to you, you said, and this was again before the election, but you said you thought maybe the best thing would be for Donald Trump to win the election in a landslide and then immediately resign and sort of cede power over to Mike Pence. Is that still something you think would be the best outcome for the party?
So I picked my words carefully, and that's not exactly what I said. What I said was, from the point of view of many conservatives, right, who of the never Trump persuasion, that's what they would like to see. I was sort of trying to describe the different strands within the party. I think that, maybe there are people who are like inveterate anti-Trump persons that remain so. But I think that, again, there is a legitimate position, even for the kind of never Trump sort of members of Congress to take here, a legitimate basis for them to wish the best for this administration. Even President Obama, who can hardly be expected to, who's not Donald Trump's best friend by any means, wished him the best and made the point that all Americans have a stake in the success of a president. And so, I mean, one thing that I think I said in that article is, we used to pray in this country for God to bless the president over the dinner table, and we said grace at the dinner table. And that's a good place to start here. I mean, every president needs God on his side. I mean, every president can use the inspiration to rise to the awesome responsibility and show the dignity and honor and benevolence and bearing that the office of the presidency requires. And if President-elect Trump rises to that challenge, then he's going to have a successful administration and he'll be recognized as such.
We're talking right now with Mario Loyola about what the Republican Party can do to heal the rifts within its own ranks. Mario is a senior fellow at the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty and a contributing editor at the National Review. And we'd like to hear from you on this. What did you think of the fractured GOP during this election? Are you a party loyalist, or are you backing Donald Trump, even if his ideas are different from the mainstream GOP? And what is your forecast for the future of the party? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation in just a bit here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert, and we're talking about how this last presidential campaign cycle caused deep fractures among the Republican Party, and what can be done to mend the divide as President-elect Donald Trump heads to the Oval Office. And we'd like to hear from you. If you're a Republican, what are your thoughts on the party as it stands today? Do you feel like the divisions can be overcome? Are they being overcome already? Did you support Donald Trump's campaign? And how is your opinion now? Call us at 800-642-1234 or leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page. Mario Loyola stays with us. He's a senior fellow at the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty and a contributing editor at the National Review. And Mario, we had a caller who couldn't stay on the line. Tom from Milwaukee would like to know, what about cooperation for the other people who didn't vote for Trump? How do you see the GOP working across the aisle, given that the country is divided and many people voted for Clinton instead?
Well, so I think the answer to that is you know, an agenda that will benefit all Americans. And I think it's fair to say, if you take an honest look at the agenda that the Speaker of the House has laid out, his A Better Way agenda, these are things that, I mean, you know, the poverty programs are obviously targeted at poor people, but these are things that are made in sort of the spirit of helping everyone in the country. And I think if we approach, for example, health reform, Let's step back from the acrimonious debate over Obamacare and think about the fact that we all are after the same thing at the end of the day. We all want a system of affordable, accessible, high-quality health care that everyone has access to. And so the question is how to deliver that, right? I mean, our criticism, you know, the criticism that conservatives have of a single-payer system is not that we disagree with the goal of affordable, accessible, high-quality care. It's that we are predicting on the basis of a series of things that we can demonstrate on a blackboard that this is not going to get us there, right? That there are several problems with it, that there are better ways. And I think if we approach these policy issues in that spirit, you're liable to get back to a politics of bipartisanship and bipartisan agreement on these big reforms. One thing that it's really important to recognize is that there, you know, the system of government by special interests and by special interest lobbyists extracting all kinds of benefits for themselves at the expense of everybody else, that is very bipartisan. There's no party that has a monopoly of this system of government by special interest that's done so much damage to our country over the last 70 years. And so I think that it's really, if you listen to candidate speeches, I mean, I understand that people voted for Senator Clinton with the best of intentions. But if you listen to her campaign speech, it was just a laundry list of special advantages for politically organized special interest groups. She hardly said a single thing that would benefit all Americans. And that's even though I know a lot of people, 65 million people, 63 million people voted for her with the best of intentions. But I think the thing is to realize that we've got to get away from the idea that personalities matter more than the actual system in which they have to operate. And we've got some problems in our system of government.
Let's take a caller now. We've got James joining us from the Wisconsin Dells. James, hi.
How's it going? Yeah, I'm really excited about, you know, the prospect of, well, the reality of President-elect Trump gaining the White House, just because I think that I've never seen it where, well, I guess, well, no, Bush had both legislative parties, the Senate and the House, were Republican, and or did he? I don't think he did have it.
He did for a few years.
Yeah. Okay. Well, Trump will have both of those groups, as well as the chance to put a conservative on the Supreme Court. I think that the prospects are unbelievable. I know that it was tough to get to this point. I know the National Review didn't want Trump to win, but, you know, we're here at this point, and we have a chance to really pass some legislation that got held up. Like, there's a lot of good legislation that came out of the House that didn't get passed.
James, can you point to a particular piece of legislation that you're excited about?
I would say probably some of the, I think some of the voter ID laws, to put it honestly. I think that the voter ID laws that died, that were kind of hatched in the House, that went through the Senate, that died, are pieces of legislation that's been passed at state level that should be at a federal deal. Just because, I mean, with the amount of people coming into the country and how certain state government bodies hand out ID cards, you know, they hand these ID cards out. People don't know if they're here legally or not.
James, thank you for the thoughts there. And Mario, what do you say to James wanting to move some stuff through that he's been looking at?
Yeah, there was a lot of good legislation that passed in the House of Representatives during the last 6 years. Some of it is stuff that people ought to be able to agree on now. I mean, for example, let's take one example. There's a piece of legislation called the RAINS Act. The purpose of the RAINS Act is to make sure that any major new executive agency regulation, like an EPA regulation or a Health and Human Services regulation, that's a significant regulation that's going to have an impact on the economy beyond a certain threshold, has to be approved by Congress. Now, that's obviously meant to sort of limit the executive's discretion, how much freedom the president has in adopting regulations pursuant to delegations of rulemaking authority from Congress. Now, the Democrats were against that during the Obama administration because President Obama had a had an agenda of big regulations that he wanted to get through, and he saw it as the only way to get his agenda through because Congress was against it. But we can all agree that there ought to be limits on the powers of the presidency. We can all agree that there ought to be limits on executive agency latitude, right? We can all agree that limits on government power are important. And I bet you that there are going to be a lot of Democrats that are going to have a change of heart about the importance of limits on presidential power now that the presidency has switched. And hopefully there will be Republicans who maintain the principles that they had during the Obama administration. That's an opportunity to redress a major imbalance that's developed in the government of the United States over several decades, which is the migration, really, of the transfer of legislative authority to the executive branch.
Now, briefly, as we start to wrap up, there are a lot of Clinton Democrats out there who think that Hillary Clinton did have policies that would have benefited them and have policies that would be more beneficial to them than Donald Trump's policies. Do you see that the GOP, in the position that it's in right now, with some of these divisions that we're talking about still remaining, do you think the GOP is in a position both to clarify its platform, to tend to its image, and also to govern both parties at this particular stage in time?
Well, you know, like I said earlier, they only have 52 votes in the Senate, and they need 60 for essentially to do whatever they want without, regardless of what the opposition thinks, right? I mean, which is the situation that President Obama had that situation only for the first 2 years, which is why Obamacare didn't have any Republican votes, right? Obamacare is just a compromise among a bunch of Democrats who disagreed with each other, right? And so that's why the law looks the way that it does. In normal times, when you don't have 60 votes controlled by one party in the Senate, everything sort of has to be compromised, and nothing's going to get through unless you've got, you know, a significant portion of votes. And I think that if the party wants to have any party that wants to have a lasting legacy needs to be able to understand the concerns of the other side. And that's one thing that we haven't seen in a long time. I mean, Bill Clinton had a lot of failings from a conservative point of view, but one thing you've got to say about the man is that he was, you know, as Trent Lott used to say, John McCain used to say, the smartest person in the room. And the reason why...
I'm sorry, we have to leave it there, but that's a good place to leave it. Mario, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Mario Loyola, Senior Fellow at the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.